Let's call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:50 p.m. It is Wednesday, May 10, 2023. Before we begin, I want to thank Joanna Crossett, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Amanda Kraft from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. This time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Kaufman. Senator Giesel is absent. She is in finance. Senator Tobin is here. Senator Keel is absent. He, too, is in finance. Myself, Senator Klayman, we have a quorum to conduct business. Our first and only order of business today is House Bill 61, Limitations on Firearm Restrictions, sponsored by Senator Tilton. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here to introduce the bill in Speaker Tilton's absence, which we, while disappointed, we fully understand that the House floor is a higher priority. And so she has her staff here, Steve St. Clair, and Heath, are you also?
Yes,
okay, so Steve St. Clair, if you would please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and you can begin your remarks.
For the record, Steve St. Clair, staff to Representative Tilton. Just real quick with the sponsor statement on HB 61, Restriction on Firearms and Other Weapons. HB 61 is a direct result to situations that occurred during the COVID-19 pandemic, not just here in Alaska, but nationwide. In at least five states, Massachusetts, Michigan, New York, New Mexico, Washington, and parts of California, closed firearm dealers deemed them non-essential, however, didn't close all businesses. They basically picking and choosing. Bingo halls, liquor stores, pot stores were left open when firearm stores were mandated to close. HB 61 reaffirms Alaskans' right to survive and protect themselves, along with the rights granted to them through the Second Amendment. HB 61 stipulates that the state, municipality, or other instrumentalities of the state may not implement new restrictions to access firearms, ammunition, firearm accessories, shooting ranges as a result of a disaster declaration. Furthermore, HB 61 also provides civil remedy to Alaskans should they have any of those, or should any of those entities decide to adopt statutes, ordinances, or policies in violation of the provisions of this bill. Nothing in HB 61 limits the state, municipality, or other instrumentalities from regulating firearms or their use within previously established constitutional and statutory boundaries.
Note that Senator Keel joined us at 1:53.
Moving on to the sectional, unless there are questions, sir. The sectional, Section 1 prohibits the state, municipalities, or other instrumentalities from restricting the following under a guise or under a disaster declaration. They cannot prohibit the possession, use, transfer of firearm accessory, or ammunition, or the seizure of above referenced items. Federal law prohibits that as it is. Limiting the quantity or restrictions on the sale service of those items as above listed, closing or limiting the hours of operation for retail establishments that sell those items unless the closure or limitations apply to all other forms of commerce. This is key here. This is not giving firearms dealers, firearm sellers any special rights. This is equity in commerce. It puts everyone on the same playing field. You close everything, gun stores are included in it also. It takes away the ability to pick and choose which facilities or means of commerce they close. Closing or limiting the hours of operation for shooting ranges, suspending or revoking concealed carry permits outside of the statutory provisions. If you're legally authorized to have a firearm or request a concealed carry, they can't stop the process from going forward. Refuse to accept an application for concealed carry permits, as I stated. Provides for civil action as relief of violation of the above referenced prohibitions. Treble damage is commonly what it's referred to. Provides section for firearm and firearm accessories. And Section 2 repeals previous definitions of firearm accessories found under the the Alaska Firearms Act, and it's just a technical change. Are there any questions on the sectional?
Senator Tobin, a question. There's a PowerPoint presentation. Is that, are you going through that as well? Or
I can if it's the desire of the committee.
Not required. I just wasn't sure whether
I was going to hit the summary of changes, sir, and then the will of the committee. If they want me to go through the presentation, I can.
So Senator Tobin has a question.
thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do just want to note one thing for the record, that today the flags are at half-mast for all of the shooting victims in Texas. And I think that is something important to note as we continue to deliberate and discuss this piece of legislation. But I do have a question directly for you. Here on page 1, section 1, I'm curious of how this might interact with Article 10 of our Constitution, which states that the purpose of this article is to provide for maximum local self-government with minimum local government units, and to prevent duplication of tax-levying jurisdictions. A liberal construction is given to the powers of local government units. So I'm curious if there is any legal opinion that you received on how this might interact with our constitutional protections on local government units being able to really maximize that local control.
Well, that would, through the chair, Senator Tobin, that would conflict with the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution also. So if you have, I do not have a legal opinion on which of those two would supersede.
Thank you.
I don't see other questions. You can proceed with what you've got.
In the summary of changes, there's only what was added. The only differences is between version A and version B are the insertion of firearm parts. And for the definition of firearm parts are an item required for the function of the weapon, whereas firearm accessories are merely accessories not required for the function. Firearm parts are an example, firing pin, barrel, slide, trigger, etc., whereas a firearm accessory could be a scope, flashlight, or sling. I can go into the PowerPoint presentation now.
Happy. I mean, I'm letting you have your presentation. So,
well, if it's the desire of the committee, if there are additional questions, it's.
I definitely think they'll be. Why don't you go ahead and go through your PowerPoint, and then we'll go to questions.
Okay. Through the chair, HB 61, an act relating to restrictions on firearms and other weapons. The main key points we want to touch on here are limiting the access to firearms impacts subsistence, protection, and violates the Constitution of the United States. When it comes to subsistence, it's about hunting. It's about feeding ourselves. In a disaster declaration, we could lose food storage. I know that food security is a concern of the state, but if people have access to their firearms and firearm accessories and ammunition, etc., they can hunt and feed themselves. 21% of Alaskan population is considered rural. In rural Alaska, 30% of the community provides 70% of the community's food based on a lot of elders in the villages. The largest number of per capita harvest of food resources comes from the Arctic and rural communities. In 2017, the harvest was roughly 402 pounds per person, compared to the average 15 pounds per person harvested by Anchorage residents. And nowhere in the U.S. is there such a heavy reliance on wild food, hunting, fishing, gathering, etc.
So I'm actually curious with a lot of these statistics. What is your estimate of the percentage of Alaskan homes that have one or more firearms in the home?
I do not have that information, Mr. Chair.
Would you think that was in the 80% or more range?
I'm sorry.
Would you think that's probably 80% or more?
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would say that more than 80% as an assumption without statistical data in front of me. A fair assumption.
I just know when people in other states ask me, what's it like going door to door in Alaska as an elected official, I always say, I would assume every house has a gun in it. And they look at me like, really? And I say, yeah, that's Alaska. Okay. Okay, please proceed.
Slide number 4. firearm restrictions impacting protection. We've all heard the stories. We've all seen the stories. A couple of examples. This year, a woman and her one-year-old son were mauled to death by a polar bear in Wales. The polar bear was killed by a man with a gun, saving additional lives. In 2017, a contract employee for Pogo Mine was killed by a black bear while collecting samples. Again, the bear was killed by a mine employee with a gun. Criminals don't follow gun laws. They're not going to, to use the analogy you used, Mr. Chairman, there is a fear from people outside of Alaska, but inside Alaska, everyone knows that everyone has guns. Firearms restrictions and the Constitution. January 2002, a federal appeals court ruled that two California counties violated the Constitution when they shut down gun stores, and it was a violation. It was Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, McDougal versus Ventura County, in which they ruled that it was unconstitutional for them to close gun stores and shooting ranges. The Second Amendment of the Constitution guarantees the right of all people to keep and bear arms. In 2008, the Supreme Court ruled in District of Columbia versus Heller that it's an individual right, not requiring, you don't have to be a member of a militia to exercise your Second Amendment rights. In 2010, the High Court ruled in McDougal versus Chicago that the right to keep and bear arms is a fundamental right that applies to the states throughout the right that also applies to the state through the 14th Amendment, which bars any state from denying liberty to a person without due process.
Would you agree if there were, I know in the last go-around there were no restrictions on firearm sales in the state of Alaska, but would you agree that the analysis of the Ninth Circuit in the California case you referenced would be the same framework a federal court would apply in Alaska because we're also in the Ninth Circuit?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Thank you.
Nationwide actions on firearms. Four states have adopted similar legislation, South Dakota, Georgia, West Virginia, North Dakota. Department of Homeland Security sent out a memorandum through FEMA identifying gun manufacturers, resellers, etc., that are considered mission critical or mission essential states or organizations, forms of commerce. Conclusion. Firearms, firearm accessories, and ammunition are part of Alaskans' way of life. They help feed families. They allow us to protect ourselves, and they're part of the Second Amendment, which grants citizens the right to bear arms. Last year, there was bipartisan support with SB 136 and HB 179 that passed unanimously out of the Senate, but was stopped a little bit short on the House side.
Thank you very much. Questions from members of the committee? I have a couple of questions. The first, I was struck in looking at the bill that it, in lines on page 1 and 2, lines 15 and 16, it basically says you can close a gun shop if you close every shop, but if you don't close every shop, you can't close a gun shop. And what struck me is that in a high emergency situation, and I don't think COVID was that high emergency, there were some restrictions, but businesses stayed open to the extent they wanted to. It strikes me in a really extreme emergency, I think of food, I think of access to water, I think of access to medical care, I think of access to pharmaceuticals, and it seems to me that those have a component of essential nature of how do we keep going as a community, that guns and liquor stores and a whole, you know, electronic shops, I could go a long list, but it seems to me there's essentials of life that could reasonably be treated differently, and I'm wondering why you would say that access to food should be on the same level as access to firearms.
Mr. Chairman, firearms allow access to food. They allow communities, people, individuals to provide for themselves versus food from a store, a shelter. And when you're talking on a disaster much, much more significant, there would probably be more federal involvement in it with the military, with martial law. I mean, we could go down a bunch of different rabbit holes.
I'm not worried about going, but I'm more kind of in, you know, say a big earthquake. We've had them in Alaska. It's great to say, well, firearms provide access to food for people that want to go in on hunt, but we've already discussed that basically every home in Alaska has firearms, and I would go so far as to say but most every home in Alaska has ammunition. And so if you had an emergency and they say, we're going to close a bunch of businesses down, it doesn't seem like this notion about, well, you need to get your firearm to go hunting. People that are going to go hunting, everybody that I that hunts, they have more than one firearm. I mean, I don't feel like the suggestion you need access to firearms to get out into a subsistence hunt in an emergency makes guns in the same place as a grocery store or a pharmacy.
Mr. Chairman, a component also there is in a disaster, large earthquake, whatever, damaged weapons and or ammunition. Not everyone has, I would say, a stockpile, if you will. But I know people that have weapons for specific things, for birds, bears, etc. But if the weapon is damaged, you can't get it replaced. If a barrel's bent, if a firing pin, a slide, those additional items, or a flood or a tsunami, your ammunition gets wet.
I'm not suggesting that there's not a reason that there shouldn't be some restrictions on, or that you shouldn't be treating businesses in general pretty equivalently, but you haven't really made a case for me about why firearms stand in the same place as pharmacy or same place as a grocery store.
Equity and commerce, sir.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. And I would like to continue following up on the chairman's questioning, and I'm going to just give you a scenario. So I represent the community of Fairview. We have the Sullivan Arena, which was used as a declared emergency shelter, and it is not a gun-free campus. It was not designated as that prior to the it being claimed for an emergency shelter purposes. If this type of provision was to pass, the fear I have is the significant increase of potential guns that would just flood the community of Fairview. And that is not a place where people are going hunting. It's not a place where people are searching for food. It's not a place where they are actually having their own domicile. They're using it as an emergency shelter, and there will be folks there who will work to exercise their Second Amendment rights. And so they did make it a gun-free campus to protect the surrounding community, to protect the kids, particularly as there is many schools in that area. So I'm curious, particularly on that section I mentioned previously around local control, the municipality of Anchorage being able to protect its community members, particularly during a declared emergency. In this case, it's difficult for me to understand why we would suspend that right of Anchorage to help its residents. And I'm going to even go further, and the Fairview Rec Center was also declared as an emergency shelter. It was single males were placed there. The Fairview Rec Center is a place where many kids hang out, where I go play pickleball. It is right next to my home that has many guns in it, as my husband is a federal law officer. And we protect ourselves, and we also protect the community with those firearms. But that's not what's at question here today, is we have access to those guns. We have many bullets. We have the ability to exercise that right. But those folks who are using that shelter in the community to protect the community, that provision was put in place to ensure that the kids in the playground were not going to be exposed to undue violence. So I'm curious how you think that isn't something that should be considered in this dialogue, protecting the citizens of an urban area, particularly the children.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, federal statute 42 U.S.C. 52007, section 706, subset 4, prohibition the carrying of firearms by any person otherwise authorized to carry firearms under federal, state, local law solely because the person is operating under the – actually, that's not the one I wanted. Number three, prohibit the possession of – yes, sir, I've got it, sir. I went one down. Prohibit the possession of firearm or promulgate any rule, regulation, order prohibiting the possession of a firearm in any place or by any person where such possession is not otherwise prohibited by state or federal law.
Senator Tobin.
Sullivan Arena. It's not a gun-free campus currently. There is nothing that prohibits someone from carrying a gun there. They did make it a gun-free campus during the pandemic, which was their right to do so as a municipality of Anchorage, a first-class city. Why would we take away that right?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, this legislation reinforces federal law. This legislation does not add that component, does not take away the right. Federal law did.
I'm actually confused by your answer, because the way I understood this legislation as I've studied the bill, if I'm the Sullivan Arena operating as we are today, there's no pandemic emergency in place in the municipality of Anchorage. If today the Anchorage Assembly and the mayor sign off on an ordinance that says no firearms in the Sullivan Arena, the Sullivan Arena is a shelter. There's a number of people there that are recognized as having some significant mental illness. It's a challenging environment in which you to have firearms. And so if the municipality passed a law that said no firearms from people that come into Sullivan Arena, and then a month later a emergency was declared, before the emergency restriction on firearms in the Sullivan Arena would be legal, but that if they tried to pass such a ordinance after the emergency had been declared, this law would prohibit them from doing it after the emergency was declared. And I think Senator Tobin's question is, why should we be restricting the municipality of Anchorage in the specific instance of the Sullivan Arena to being able to say, we want to make this a drug-free campus because stresses are higher during the emergency and we don't want any guns in it? Why shouldn't they be allowed to do that?
Mr. Chairman, it's in federal law.
What does the federal law say?
That's what I read a little bit earlier. Again, 42 U.S.C. 5207, Section 706, Subsection 3, prohibition of any firearms or promulgate any rule, regulation, or order prohibiting the possession of a firearm in any place or by any person where such possession is not otherwise prohibited by state or federal law.
So does that mean that they can issue the ordinance, or you're saying the federal law would prohibit them doing it anyway?
Through the chair, this is just HB 61 is just reinforcing what is already in federal law. That may be a legal question that we need to get an opine on.
Senator Tobin?
Thank you. And I'm just going to follow up because I'm very curious. I'm going to use Centennial Park, which was open to have our homeless folks go to. It's not a declared space that's a gun-free campus. However, it was declared to be so during the pandemic as it was used as an emergency space for houseless folks. That would have I'm curious how this would impact that ability. If we could have a legal opinion on that or some expertise to help us understand what exactly this piece of legislation for us is doing when it comes to the ability for Anchorage to protect its residents, to Anchorage protect its young people, and protect the citizens of the community. I'm very curious.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, I'll try and get a legal opine on that.
Another section of the bill that I had questions about is on page 2, lines 13 through 19. There's provisions in there that provide who should have standing to bring lawsuits. And my understanding of Alaska Supreme Court precedent over many years is that we have one of the most liberal standing provisions in both existing statutes and common law decided by the Supreme Court that allows a whole range of people to come in and bring lawsuits. Why do we need some additional provisions here that's not already covered by existing law that would allow plenty of folks to come in and have standing to bring a lawsuit?
Mr. Chairman, this is the same language that was in legislation that passed last year and similar legislation.
Not the question I'm asking. I'm asking you a question about the standing requirement, the standing decisions from the Alaska Supreme Court about standing and whether we need anything like this in legislation, because the decisions by the Alaska Supreme Court on standing have a very, very liberal standing standard. I would note much more liberal standing rulings than is applied by the U.S. Supreme Court and the federal court.
I'll have to get back with you on that, sir.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. I also have another question there on page 2, line 22, around the three times the legal fees. How was that number determined? What brought you to that particular provision?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, that again was language that was taken from similar bills, and to give some teeth to the to the bill for a violation of the Second Amendment.
Senator Tobin.
Why would we tell the court what to do? I know that they're a separate body, and they would determine damages if a case was brought before them, and they adjudicated it in favor of the plaintiff. So I'm curious, why would we? How did we come around this amount? Like, where did this amount come from?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin. We received a legal memo that should be in your packet that talks about the number of time treble damages, injunctive damages, etc. It was based on previous legislation that had passed in other states, and I believe there were 14 cases in which the term treble damages was used or is used in Alaska statute.
On the treble damages question, did any of the states that you referenced, not Alaska, specifically allow treble damages against a government entity as opposed to private entities?
Through the chair, I'd have to go back and look at them, but I would say no, because the Second Amendment only applies to interference by the government, not by a person, a private entity.
So walk me through, when you say no, what do you mean no? These were only treble damages assessed against government entities?
Through the chair, I would have to go back and look at the pieces of legislation. I know that it is in treble damages is in one of the, or several, actually I think it's only one, North Dakota, I believe.
I saw you reference the four states that had passed legislation. I actually looked at the North Dakota statute, and that doesn't have treble damages provisions, unless I'm mistaken.
Just a moment, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking for it.
This one referred item 2 in the respect to treble damage. I
will have to get back with you on that, Mr. Chairman.
So in terms of I would actually ask, as to the four states, let us know if any of them have adopted provisions regarding treble damages.
I know one of, through the chair, Mr. Chairman, I know one of them does, and I thought I knew where it was, but I don't have it right here in front of me.
I think Senator Kaufman has a question.
No, sir, I just, that comment.
This doesn't require a response. I just have, we have some provisions in statute involving the application of treble damages. My general understanding of those is that it's about private entities, and this would be the first time we made the government subject to treble damages. So I view that as a fairly bold move in terms of treble damages, and they're in statute, but I, in large measure, have seen a number of places where I think our treble damages statute has had unintended consequences and I think is problematic in a number of ways, so I have questions. But On the same, and this is the question I will ask, have you looked into the question about this treble damages provision, how that relates to the principles of sovereign immunity, and is the state waiving its right to sovereign immunity by passing this legislation?
Mr. Chairman, within your packet again is another legal document that talks about sovereign immunity and immunity based on the individual. The governor, police officers who were just doing what they were instructed to do, that qualified immunity was the term I was looking for.
Okay. And so can you explain a situation in which if a mayor were to issue an executive order, an example here, if the mayor issued an executive order saying no guns in the Sullivan Arena, Would the mayor then be subject, could the mayor claim immunity if he was sued for treble damages by a gun rights organization?
Mr. Chairman, are you talking about suing the mayor specifically as an individual or the city?
Well, both.
Well, the city doesn't necessarily have qualified immunity, whereas the mayor would.
Why wouldn't the city have qualified immunity? What's the point of sovereign immunity if the sovereign, which is the city in this case, why wouldn't the city have the ability to assert sovereign immunity and say we're not subject to damages, we haven't waived our right to sovereign immunity?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have to get back with you, get back with the committee on that.
We're actually going to have to take a brief at ease. Back on record. So I was asking you questions about sovereign immunity, I believe.
Through the chair, within the legal memo provided, the number three, the doctrine of qualified immunity shields officials from civil liability as long as their conduct does not violate clearly established constitutional rights of which a reasonable person would have known.
Right, so that's the question. Now you've got this law passes, and the mayor signs an executive order that says no guns in the Sylvan Arena. Aren't you saying that this law reinforces the Constitution, and so if the mayor's signing that, he's making himself personally liable for signing an executive order that violates constitutional rights that are well known as reflected by this statute?
Mr. Chairman, potentially.
And why should the municipality of Anchorage waive its sovereign? I mean, does this by passing this law, do we cause this municipality of Anchorage to waive their sovereign immunity by passing this law?
Mr. Chairman, I'd have to get a legal opine on that. That's above my scope.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, also the state of Georgia has, and I was using a term incorrectly when it came to treble damages, because again, in the legal memo that we received on number three, number two. While punitive damages are in the amount of three times the plaintiff's attorney fees, these damages are not what is typically referred to as treble damages. And in our the bill, It's on page 2, line 22, actually 23, three times the plaintiff's attorney fees. So it's not the actual damages, it's the attorney fees.
I'm sorry, which page on the bill again?
On the, through the chair, on the legal services memo, that would be page 2.
No, but on the bill itself, you're talking.
Oh, on the bill itself? It would be page 2, line 23.
Is there any other instance in Alaska statute in which there are provisions to allow tripling the attorney's fees?
In this memo, sir, through the chair, it specifies on the second page, treble or triple damages are authorized in 14 different statutes in comparison to injunctive relief, et cetera, sir. So this isn't the only instance or would not be the only instance.
You're telling me that if I look at these statutes, there are specific provisions about tripling the attorney's fees as opposed to tripling the economic damages or tripling the other damages that are awarded by the court unrelated to attorney's fees? Or if you don't know the answer, you should say.
Sir, I do not know the answer.
I would predict that if you, and I don't think this answers the question, I think as near as I'm aware of, the challenge of attorney's fees historically is whether the plaintiff or the defendant is entitled to actual attorney's fees. And I'm not aware of any instance in Alaska statute in which a tripling of the attorney's fees is allowed. There are certainly instances, and I think these sites reference them, in which you're able to triple the damages unrelated to the attorney's fees. But I'm not familiar with an instance in which you're able to claim triple attorney's fees. And so my question, which you don't have to answer, but I would ask you to get some research, is why should we be creating an exception that allows to triple the attorney's fees when we've had extensive case law about when a party's entitled to actual attorney's fees, but as far as I'm aware of, never specific attorney's fees?
Mr. Chairman, I'll get that information for you. And just to expound on that a little bit, I found in the state of Georgia on their legislation, their SB 214, in their subsection, they also list liquidation damages of three times the plaintiff's attorney fees.
Okay. Absolutely. Senator Kaufman, I was glad you want to get in the party.
I've been here. I just wanted to note for the record on page 2 at the very top of the memo, what it says is treble or triple damages. Now, that comes after it makes the distinction between the two types of damages are authorized in 14 different. So it's saying it's some combination of those in 14 different statutes. I just want to mention that for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. And Senator Kaufman, that's actually what I was asking about, because there's several places in which they are specifically authorized, but those are almost all the damages, which as my understanding, the calculation of damages is a separate analysis than attorney's fees. So,
thanks. If I may, understood. But I was just, because previously it sounded like the treble or triple damages was being conflated, and I was just making sure that wasn't the case in our conversations, and that this statement is referring to both the possibilities of both, not one or the other.
Right, and I think the point that you've highlighted, which is correct, which is a clarification on the bill that I think has been misunderstood by people commenting in some of the communications I've seen, is that it's conflating triple damages of the economic damages, and tripling the economic damages sometimes is the punitive, that's your punitive award, is you triple the economic damages. And what you've really highlighted, and I appreciate it, is that there's no tripling of the economic damages under this proposal. The tripling is only of the attorney's fees. Any other questions from the committee? Hearing none. we are going to adjourn for the day. We've left you with many questions.
Mr. Chairman, I will get answers to the questions, sir.
Okay. Our next meeting is Friday, May 12th at 1:30 p.m. We will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:39 p.m.